What would you rather have, Andy? Brunch with Bryan Cranston or Anna Gunn?
What is this? You're setting me up. This is a setup.
What? You're gonna call... like dinner with Jay-Z or Beyonce. Because
if I say Bryan Cranston, you're going to call me a sexist, like, bad fan. But if I say Anna Gunn, you're going to say I'm, like, virtue signaling or whatever.
Whoa, wait. Oh. Say that I'm going to say that. I don't say that to people.
Noé, Loach, Malik, Odiar, Gavone, Sorrentino, Maiwen, Dolan, and tant d'autres.
Welcome to Can I Kick It? This is a podcast about film festivals. My name is Emilio Diaz. Joining me today is...
Andy Gramuga.
Colin Ashley.
So this week on the podcast, we're going to talk about a variety of things. We got some news to discuss. We are going to talk a little bit about the HBO series The Sympathizer and Hundreds of Beavers. Plus, we're going to do some Cannes predictions. Award winners across
our last episode before Cannes begins.
If it does. Which we'll get into
in a minute.
Yeah. Before we get into that specific piece of news, I guess a main piece of news is that Audrey Dewan, Golden Lion winner for her last film, Happening, will premiere her new film, Emmanuel, a remake of Emmanuel, at the San Sebastian Film Festival.
Yes.
Which is sort of interesting, given that it is a lower profile festival than the other ones, and she just won a big award.
Yeah.
Don't know what that signals about the movie.
Right. We had sort of been heavily speculating that it would play at Cannes. It was in, like, a bunch of our, like, too early predictions and stuff. And I think that was, it was even one we were, like, potentially pointing to as, like, a could be a later edition because she's French. But yeah, it's going straight to San Sebastian. The festival of Rifkins.
So true.
It's so crazy that that's like all I can think about whenever San Sebastian comes up is like that's the one where Rifkin's festival played,
and we haven't even done our episode on it yet.
No, and we never will. But yeah, Naomi Merlant's in this. Naomi Watts, poor Naomi Watts.
As soon as Naomi Watts was in it, we knew it couldn't premiere again.
That's right. Will Sharp, yeah, Jamie Campbell-Bauer. Few other people. Although I guess last year, Boy in the Heron opened at San Sebastian. It was the opening film at San Sebastian, but
you know, it didn't premiere at San Sebastian.
Sure, it had opened in Japan. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is interesting. Anyway, I guess the only other news we have is the Cannes stuff. Which is that there might be a strike, a film worker strike at the festival.
Yes.
There is a labor group in France that is a sort of collective of film workers.
Specifically, freelance festival workers, specifically.
Yeah, freelance festival workers. Called the Sous le Champ de Dèche. Or is that the... Wait.
Yeah.
Did I get... Yeah, okay, yeah. I did get that right. They are planning to strike during the festival currently due to sort of poor pay conditions and also other things relating to unemployment benefits.
Right, it's...
In France.
This is what is interesting about it to me, is it specifically seems... a little more in response to, like, French labor laws and like, governmental sort of actions at this point than it does, like, specifically about, like, the way the festival is organized and things like that. Which is not to say, like, the festival is not implicated at all, and obviously that's who they would be striking against if they were to go to strike. But, you know, Cannes has put out a statement acknowledging the difficulties that the French unemployment insurance sort of reform is causing, and that they want to, like, come to a bargaining table with this group and with other stakeholders, yeah. I think.
Which is, like, from a cursory reading of the things involved, what seems to have changed is that there is a series of unemployment benefits that are given to French, like, freelance workers, including those in the entertainment industry, that due to some loophole or something are not allowed to be given to people who work at freelance festival workers.
Right. Or there's a change that's going to make it them ineligible for it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they are basically striking for the right to have those unemployment benefits given to them, plus, like, more pay and stuff, because it is a sort of thing where it's like, yeah,
classic
it is
more strike stuff also, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it is directed at, like, you know, labor, you know, labor ministries and stuff like that. But there is also a certain segment of, like, if Can wanted to help move these things along and change, they could, and they're maybe not doing everything they can to help make those things happen. So, you know, yeah, solidarity with the workers. As Andy said, Can does seem to have an interest in going to the bargaining table and figuring this stuff out, as I'm sure they are 1 week away from all of this starting.
Yeah.
Whether this will end up actually interrupting the festival, or will they come to some sort of agreement, we do not know yet, because a lot of this stuff seems to have ramped up quickly this week. You know, hopefully the workers get what they want, because they seem to do a lot of very important work for the festival, and they deserve to make a living wage from it. So, you know, every year at Cannes, we like thinking about what might win, thinking about where certain awards go. We usually do Palme d'Or predictions. Yeah, we do Palme d'Or predictions. This year, we're going a little heavier. We're going to predict the, you know, entire lineup of awards. You know, it's not like there's that many. I feel like we can get through this pretty quickly. And since we have our full lineup, we have our full jury.
We have our insight. We can, you know, point to, like, there's no way they're going to give it to Megalopolis. I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, Cullen thinks the hit is out.
I don't think the hit is out. I just don't see it happening with his jury. And I'd love to be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about last week what jury it would require for it to happen.
Which is me, of course. Me and then the Rat Pack.
The Rat Pack?
No, the pack. Rat Pack, but that's also wrong.
The Film Brats.
Film Brats, of course.
Thinking of, like, Frank Sinatra, like, and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr.
I said
Jr.
Brat Pack. Which is,
oh,
fucking,
sure.
Like,
that's also a different.
Emilio Estevez, Molly Ringwald, right, you know, yeah. Fucking John Hughes' buddies.
I guess they're in The Outsider, so they I guess they have a better chance.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
They have a better chance than other people.
I feel like The Apprentice is going to win something big.
Probably. Right. Is it going to be actor, or is it going to be, like, Palmer Prix? Like,
I think
Sebastian Stan winning an acting award at Cannes seems crazy. But maybe they would give it to Jeremy Strong. Maybe that's what they would do, is they'd be like, do the, like, the supporting winner for a lead actor, for their sole acting prize for a, you know, male actor.
I don't know. I guess it's interesting. It's all very interesting. I've seen Bird pick up Palme d'Or.
Yeah, I mean, You can. I've.
There's a narrative there for sure.
Yes. The Arnold return. There's the, you know, everyone likes Barry Keoghan.
Yeah.
Rogowski.
We get Rogowski. Right. She hasn't been there in a minute. I guess, not been in there in a minute. Or whatever, but that was director Fortnite.
Or was
Cow and Comp?
Did Greta Gerwig direct Little Women after Big Little Lies season 2 was made?
That's a great question.
I want to know.
It came out in summer of 2019, and Little Women was winter of 2019. But it's like, what's the production schedule on Little Women? Right. Like?
Was Meryl giving Greta like Andrea Arnold's getting hosed goss like on the set of Little Women? Like, this is my question.
I'm gonna say
Meryl be at camp.
She'll be
getting an honorary award, so Meryl will be there. So
her and George Lucas.
Lucas and Studio Ghibli.
If the goss hadn't been delivered yet, it could still be delivered. Get it this
time. I'm sure she's found out since.
I mean, sure, yes.
I don't know, maybe Meryl's not a texter.
Maybe not. I bet Meryl writes emails. I bet Meryl's an email person.
E-Meryl.
Uh-huh.
Any thoughts?
On other potential Palm winners?
Screenplay O Canada.
Okay.
I feel we're going too English here, you know?
Right, we're circling in on all the, the ones with American movie stars in them.
Blame the lineup.
Sorrentino, what do we think?
Nothing.
Getting a jury prize?
Sorrentino's the lettuce of these lineups at this point. He's just here so you can legally call this a lineup. He's not. Yeah.
Sure.
He's rough edge.
Maybe the Jia Zhang Ke movie could win the Palm.
That certainly could. He is a legend. He is a legend for sure. What's the Coralie Farjiat film, The Substance?
This is, the horror movie with Margaret Qualley.
Yeah, Margaret Qualley, Demi Moore. That's a Universal film, which is the crazy.
Whoa.
Demi Moore was just talking about that on the Met Gala red carpet.
The animated Hazanavicius, maybe?
That would be really funny if that won the Palm, for sure.
I don't think...
And Neon was like, well, I guess we have to pick this up.
I feel like Kinds of Kindness will not win.
Is Kinds of Kindness Neon?
That is a good question. I don't think it
is. Element, Film 4, and TSG, distributed by Searchlight, of course.
It's another Searchlight, right. He's in with Searchlight.
If we're looking at the Neon movie, the Sean Baker movie is Neon.
Yeah, but... It can't be another Neon. I refuse to let them do this. If they give it to another Neon movie, it'll be... The Fix is in. We can't take it seriously anymore.
The Fix will officially be in.
At that point, they're paying the refs.
That would be really crazy if there was like a bribery scandal from Neon to the various film festival jury presidents. Like,
A logline did come out for the Sean Baker movie, so
it and a runtime, right? It's quite long, I believe.
Well, it's just long. It's like 140 minutes, basically.
Yeah. A young sex worker from Brooklyn marries the son of a Russian oligarch. Her fairy tale marriage is threatened when man's parents travel to New York to force an annulment. So yeah, it's I'm gonna say the winner will be I think we need... It's all very interesting. I think Megalopolis will win something. I think they will give it
a classic, like, jury prize or, like, special made-up award sort of deal. Like...
Yeah, I think it'll be jury prize. I think they'll give it a, like... We appreciate... It's great that you made this.
Right, like... Yeah. Good job getting it over the finish line, bud. Thank you. Like,
but
yeah, I'm gonna say, yeah. I'm just gonna go first thought, best thought. Do the whole slate. Give me 1 second to collect myself.
I love you collecting yourself. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different directions all of this could go. Obviously, acting awards is kind of the hardest to predict because, you know, a lot of them will be actors we're not familiar with because they are more foreign actors sort of breaking through here in, you know, languages and movies that we're not that familiar with. Like, though, I guess this is, if there were ever, like, two, like, English-speaking Americans, it would be this one because there are a lot of movies in English, or movies with, like, American movie stars in this line, you know. Or I guess people are familiar with, because I guess I'm thinking of, like, Rogowski, and obviously he's, like, very much a foreign actor, but he is more of the sort of person we're familiar with than, like, other people.
Yeah.
If I were to, like, really put my thumb, I'd say Megalopolis is wearing jury prize.
I agree with that. I like that.
And then Arnold win the Palm. I think the Fargo. I kind of like that movie as a Palm d'Or winner, actually.
I don't see that.
I feel like people really like her other movie. I feel like people really like Revenge. I feel like there's an excitement about her.
People like Revenge. I've seen some people that also don't like that movie. Maybe they'll give Chiara Mastroianni the award for playing her father. The acting award.
Okay.
Palm Bird, Pre-Apprentice, Jury Megalopolis, actress Zhao Tao, actor Vincent Cassell, and then director and screenplay is where I'm sort of like, this could go anywhere.
Maybe the...
I think director will be one of Gomes or Kapadia. I think it'll go to one of those.
Yeah, I was looking at Gomes for director or screenplay. Yeah, I was like...
I don't know. His movies are always like... him being in competition is a good sign, I suppose, because they didn't put Segura Diaries in comp, but maybe, you know, the Odiard, people like him, maybe it'll be his, he'll get a second Palm.
What
was Odiard's last movie?
His last movie was Parents 13th District. Which was, like, the sort of love, not anthology, but, like, intertwining stories movie that he, like...
really didn't like it, right?
Yeah, I thought that movie was very bad. And I like Sisters Brothers a lot. And I thought A Prophet was, like, solid. But I really disliked Paris 13th District.
Right.
And didn't he do... I didn't see Dupont, but he maybe did another movie that I saw and disliked.
Rust and Bone? Is that him?
I haven't seen Rust and Bone.
What else could it be?
I don't know.
A Prophet?
Yorgos just won the Golden Lion. I feel like...
Yeah.
We can't give him another...
Who's saying that he's going to?
No. I'm thinking out loud.
Sure. Like,
what if it's finally the Sarah Branagh time? What if it's finally...
No, I don't think that'll happen. I think that movie will...
do poorly,
not be received well. What about Beating Hearts?
That's a comedy musical. It's a swing. For sure.
Yeah. I think we're in a good spot. We don't think Schrader's screenplay. It is really hard to not lean, like, on the people that I know.
Right. I don't think Schrader will win anything. He seems like a classic, like... There's a couple people that really respond to it, and then otherwise other people are left cold by it sort of deal. That doesn't spell to consensus winner of anything.
Yeah. That movie's gonna be interesting. I'm excited for that movie, but I also do not really see it winning anything. The Rosoloff, that's interesting. That one might win something. That seems interesting to me.
Yeah, there's the movies like... There's that one, there's 3 Kilometers to the End of the World and Wild Diamond, where I'm like, I don't really know these people. But it could win something.
Romanian, always interesting to me, but I don't know if those movies ever really win. They're more just, like, interesting.
Well, what was the one from, like, the mid-2000s, like, 4 weeks?
Yeah,
three days. 4 weeks, you know, 3 months, and 2 days, yeah.
3 months,
yeah.
2 days.
That's Romanian, correct?
Yeah.
I believe so.
Manuel Parvus, 3 Kilometers to the End of the World.
And Kareem Anouz, who did
fucking Firebrand.
Firebrand is back.
Is back. After Motel making a movie Destino. With very that famous people and a very in a very, like, you know, in the zeitgeist topic. A movie that just straight up never came out, really.
I need to see Firebrand.
You needed to see Firebrand. It's a very Firebrand. Interesting statement.
My top priorities of, like, movies I want to see are Pool Man. Then Firebrand, then Megalopolis.
In that order?
Sounds like it. And we're gonna hold him to it. If he watches those movies not in that order, we're gonna yell at him.
I feel like I can easily have that done. Pullman will be out by the end of this episode.
Yeah, Pullman will have escaped by the end of this episode.
You're being very
the girl with the needle.
You're being very committed to Pullman. I feel like it's gonna.
I'm not very.
It's gonna backfire.
Just, what do you mean? I'm just interested to see it. Even if it's bad, it won't be uninteresting.
Sure.
It's something for sure. As a person who's seen Pool Man,
I'm just hot off of listening, and maybe we'll save this for special presentations.
But yeah.
Off of Pine's WTF.
Sure. You love Pine.
Yeah, I think the predictions went well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anything sticking out to you, Andy?
Anything what?
Sticking out to you?
Sticking out to me.
Girl with the Needle?
There's, who's, the first time director, the, Wild Diamond, the Agatha Reidinger?
Reidinger, yeah.
That's always, like, first time director in competition is always interesting. I feel like it doesn't often bear fruit, but sometimes it really can.
Sure.
So that's something to keep in mind.
That is interesting. I guess to end this segment, what is the movie on this lineup that you are most excited to just see the reaction to?
To see the reaction to.
Interesting.
Yeah. I guess I'm curious about the Odiard, I think, because, like, it's got
could go a lot of ways.
Right. It's got, like, musical elements. It's got, like, Selena Gomez, Zoe Saldana, and Edgar Ramirez in supporting roles. Like, there's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that could go in a lot of directions for sure.
Colin?
I mean, it's hard not to say Megalopolis, but
certainly feel free.
I definitely want to hear, like, what people think of Shrouds, and, like, It'll be a nice needle mover to see what the reaction to The Apprentice is, obviously, as well.
Yeah, just getting a handle on, like, what that is, and, like, always, of course, interested to see if there's, like, a Euro-American critic split on that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, maybe it'll be like a...
I think there will be.
A big political message like Fahrenheit 9/11 winning. The Apprentice will win in the election year.
That's right.
Yeah, I guess if I had to say one, I am kind of interested in the Arnold, because she hasn't made, like, a fiction feature film in such a long time. I do feel like... I don't know. The world has changed. I don't know if the appetite for the kind of movie that Andre Arnold makes has changed, and if it's changed for the better or the worse. Yeah. And that is sort of fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am very interested to see, like, the critical reception to it. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that could go a lot of different ways here. You know, I think with a lot of Cannes lineups, the stuff I have no idea about, I'm almost more interested
in. Yeah, like, that's always the thing, is, like, what's gonna pop? Like,
exactly.
Yeah. It's like, but this one of these has to be something. So I'm interested. What were you gonna say, Colin?
I just feel like maybe it's just that we've been doing this podcast for so long that we're seeing the names over and over again.
Right.
But I feel like more than recent years, this is one where I'm like, it is a very, like, recognizable list of people. There's, like, maybe four or five names that I'm like, I have not heard of this person. Whereas, like, you look at old Cannes lineups and I'm like, I've heard of, like, two of these movies, maybe.
Yeah.
Some, or, you know, sure. Like, less than this, for sure. But I think it's also just, like, you know.
Yeah. Right.
The, 5 years deep, we've been in it.
Also, I'll say that there are people like Kapadia and Gomes where it's like, those are names we know, but they're not exactly, not where I would expect to see them. They've sort of upgraded a little bit.
Right. Yeah. Are they breaking out? Like, are we witnessing a breakout of someone who we've had an eye on for a minute?
Yeah.
An exciting narrative.
We'll see what happens with Cannes and whether any of these movies will actually screen next week.
Yeah,
that's right.
Anyway, The Sympathizer.
Yes. So, this is it's the new project on HBO. It is an adaptation of a novel that Emilio has read.
Novel I have read for sure.
By Viet Thanh Nguyen. It is adapted by Park Chan-wook and Don McKellar, with them both, I think, on every episode so far. They have, like, both had, like, full, like, screenwriting credit. And, like, they have a shared created by credit. It's produced by and features Robert Downey Jr. in multiple roles. That's sort of like the big, like, starry role. He's, like, playing several antagonists, and then a newcomer is the lead, whose name is Hua Juande, sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, who's playing the captain. Who's the main character who's tying everything together. And what I think is, like, he's a pretty good, great find. Like, he's incredibly striking, and, like, I think he holds the screen really well. I've been excited to see his performance throughout this show. As we record this and as this episode is released, 4 episodes have come out, the first 3 of which were directed by Park Chan-wook. The 4th episode that just dropped this past Sunday was, of course, directed by Fernando Méliès, Mr. Two Popes himself, who's also the main director on Sugar, airing on Apple TV Plus right now. So he's really having a moment. Emilio and I
might argue that it's the opposite of a moment.
Yeah, what are you doing? Sugar on Apple TV Plus?
Yeah, everyone's talking about Sugar. The twist that just was true. Was just revealed.
The twist?
Yeah. It's a big twist. You haven't heard about the twist?
I heard about it when it premiered.
Yeah.
Because I did hear about the twist.
Yeah.
I saw, I mean, there was a clip going around of that show that looked really bad, which is obviously you can't judge a show by its clip.
Sure.
Judge a show by its clip.
I keep, right, the thing about it is it's a half hour drama, which is I'm like always intrigued by.
Oh, that's Sugar.
Yeah.
Don't talk about Sugar anymore, but get back to the Sympathizer, sorry.
We can get back to talking about the Sympathizer. So yes, Amelia and I have been watching, we've seen all four episodes that have been released thus far. Emilio, let's start off with your thoughts about how it's been going so far.
I mean, as a person who's read the book, it's a very interesting adaptation, because the book is incredibly first person, and the entire sort of conceit of the book is that you're sort of hearing from this person who is like, I'm a man of two faces. I'm everything to everyone. Like,
right,
who I am is sort of less important to the sort of goals I'm trying to achieve at the moment, and it's sort of it's a very first person saying about a sort of loss of identity. So it will always mm-hmm. be fascinating to try to adapt something where that needs to be an actual character,
right? You gotta have a person there. Yeah.
You have to have a person who is making choices there, and I think as you said, it's the actor playing the role of Washonde is doing a good job at sort of playing a real person who is also kind of blank, combined mm-hmm. with, a lot of the direction of the series, Park Chan-wook. He's a guy who's he likes playing in sort of pulpy, sort of exploitation-y
right.
realms, and he is adding a lot of flair to the stuff in the show, which is sort of fascinating, because it's it's obviously putting a lot of panache and putting a lot of artistic flourishes on the thing, when the book is obviously the way it's written is very artistic and it's very accomplished, but a lot of the meat and potatoes of it is just very research stuff about the time period.
Sure.
So to get an adaptation that is more It has to make bold artistic choices to depict these sort of things rather than just go for a sort of grounded realism mm-hmm. the whole time is a sort of fascinating conceit. The Robert Downey Jr. thing is a thing that I think I have been up and down on.
Sure.
I think some of the performances register better than others. I think as an overall conceit, it's I get what he's doing. I'm just the variety of characters he's playing are sort of representing this broad spectrum of American ignorance of just these people who are trying to exert their control over the main character in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And having Robert Downey Jr. Sort of be the face of just annoying white Americanism is sort of an interesting take.
Yeah.
I think the one he played in the last episode is sort of, it's good, but it's also the one that is the least him doing a big character. It is
right.
The one where who is the most in Robert Downey Jr. mode.
Right.
Yes. That character is Nikos Damianos, who is the director of the film that
the main character is serving a consultant on.
Yeah, he is consulting.
Right.
And that episode is also... Yeah, that episode is fascinating from multiple levels. First, because it's it used to be a section in the book where it was a book about making a movie, and now it is fully a filmed thing about trying to make a movie to all the Tropic Thunder parallels,
Right.
You're trying mm-hmm. to make a thing about the Vietnam War with Robert Downey Jr. doing a crazy character throughout it. Third, it is of what I've seen so far and what I can remember from reading the book, it is the part of the show that has most diverged from what is in the book.
Sure. Yes. That character, right. It is kind of the most Robert Downey Jr. doing his thing, which is not to say he's not doing his thing all over this show, but it is sort of this is Robert Downey Jr. Playing a Francis Ford Coppola sort of inspired director. Who is in love with his artistic genius, and perhaps that has closed him off to other things about the world that he's sort of not putting together. the, yeah, that, I mean, right, and so it's sort of, it has been, like, one character at a time sort of introduced, I guess, like, like, the first episode only had one RDJ character, I think the second one then introduced the other one, the director was introduced at the end of the third episode, but, like, the third character, I guess, who the congressman, who I feel like is the one who has registered least so far, was also introduced earlier in that episode. And, like, yeah, that third episode does build to, like, the big, like, the clumps scene, right? They're all together, sitting around a table, sort of, like, talking to each other. Like, showpiece that you know is coming when you see that Robert Downey Jr. is playing, like, a lot of different characters. He's very charming and fun in a lot of these different characters. The professor one, the academic, is the one who's, like, popping the most to me currently as, like, this is a very interesting performance, and is also, I feel like, the kind of performance you only get when you are playing three other characters in a thing, and so you're like, I have to make them all very different, and so I'm really gonna make some, like, really, like, departure for me choices to play this character. I feel like the professor is the one who's seeing the most benefit of that, in terms of, like, what the performance is doing. I do think, like, overall the show, like, it's been very well structured so far, in that, like, the episodes are very distinct. Like, the first one is him getting out of Vietnam, the second one is him getting more acclimated to America, the third one is largely about this assassination plot that he has to undertake, and then the fourth one is about the making of this movie. I'm really interested to see how it goes, and I do think, like, yeah, not having read the book, that, like, I'm just incredibly intrigued, and I'm incredibly struck by, like, the central performance, and then, like, there's a lot of fun stuff around the edges.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you think you'll keep watching?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, there's only three more episodes. It's a 7-episode miniseries, so, which is, like, a very weird length, but I guess I have a vague idea of just, like, the 7 things they took from the book to make an episode, so, which is, I guess, a funny thing to think about the book. Because the weird thing in the book is, it's like, it is very, like, it can read as, like, rambly, since it's so first person, and then at the end you sort of understand why it's rambly. Though, I guess, like, in the show, they sort of foreground that, like, the framing of the story is a confession he is writing at a
at a
prison camp. That is more of a reveal in the book, but in the, I guess, for the purposes of making it into a TV show, they have to sort of foreground that aspect of just, like, having that frame story, so you do sort of understand why it becomes so rambly, because you sort of know that this is, like, a person trying to explain themselves
and they have
sort of thing. In
the fourth episode, they really call attention to that too, because there's, like, a couple of times where he's like, I know this is a scene that, like, I'm not technically present for, and, like, so I'm sort of speculating on, like, what was happening at this moment. Like, it wasn't until that fourth episode that I was like, oh yeah, he has been in, like, every scene of this, and, like, this is all his perspective on this entire thing only so far, which has been, like, it's an interesting calling attention to it so hugely in the fourth episode has made me think back on the earlier episodes in a different way, which is always exciting to do partway through a series.
Yeah, because, like, in the show, they have to give him, like, the name The Captain, because it's, like, in the book that he doesn't have a name, because it's, like, nobody's ever, he's not ever being referred to, because he's always present.
Yeah.
Which is sort of fascinating.
Yeah.
But,
it's Park directed the first 3 episodes. Like, I would say in every episode you can see, like, oh, that's, like, why he was excited to direct this. Like, every episode has, like, a sequence like that. In the first episode, it's, like, them, the scene of them, like, trying to get on the plane is, like, explosions are happening and stuff. And then, like, in the third episode, it does feel like it's the... Well, there's like, the assassination scene where, like, he pulls back to a wide shot and you see, like, the mother-in-law or whatever on the roof. And, like, it's a big wide and there's stuff happening, like, on multiple levels. And you're like, this is really exciting and dynamically filmed. And then, yeah, that last sequence where it is... Where it is four Downey Juniors, and they're like at a steakhouse, and then like a sex club of some sort.
Is big. And I also think for sure it's like, obviously he's the guy who he has sort of like a similar frame of reference of movie that's like a guy like Tarantino does. So I imagine him getting to make something in like 70s LA and like that sort of patina that has like violence and sort of intrigue and stuff sort of appealed to him.
So yeah.
Did that sound so interesting?
I also want to call out, I've never seen this in an HBO show before. The famous HBO hum, it does the static and then the HBO logo. And then instead of like cutting to black and then starting the show, it zooms into the O and then it becomes like a 70s sort of like film grain sort of like transition there, and it really blew my mind the first time it happened.
The first person to use the HBO, that's very funny.
I mean, it maybe has happened before, but this is the first time I've ever noted it.
Who's directing the rest of it?
There's two more, or one or two more.
There's three more, and they're all directed by Mark Munden. I guess he just directed a bunch of British TV. He directed that show Utopia, which was like...
Oh, sure.
A big thing back when it came out.
Yeah, where it was like, there was going to be the Gillian Flynn, David Fincher Utopia thing, and then it didn't happen, and then a new show came out called Utopia. They really...
And he,
Do you feel like, Andy, since you've watched all of his movies,
that... Yeah.
You understand his style a lot more? Like, can you track it throughout all of it to
I mean, right, he has a very...
I'm very underseen on him.
Sure, he has a very in-your-face style. Like, it's like, it's not...
Sure,
if you've seen a couple, it's, like, not hard to, like, pick out the tropes and the trends or whatever of what he likes to do, I feel like. It is interesting having seen Little Drummer Girl also...
Because he directed all of that.
He directed every episode of that, which I feel like is...
But there was like, isn't it like three, like 2.5 hour things, right? Or was it like 6 1-hour
episodes? It's like, yeah, it's like 5 or 6 1-hour episodes, I think.
But I think...
There was a different cut. I don't know.
I remember sometimes watching it as British cuts three, like that. Three long things.
Sure. You have seen that, right, Cullen?
I've seen, back when it came out.
Yeah. The thing about that was like, I feel like... The thing that really popped in that was like the production design and like the
costuming.
Right. Yeah. It was like, it was really like the on the ground aesthetic sort of the whole show was really where you felt his influence the most, more than like the individual sequences and stuff. And I wonder if that was a factor of like, when you're directing TV, you just have to do so much so quickly that like, he didn't have time for as much of the cinematography flourishes quite as much, which he probably had a little more time, you know, directing only three episodes of The Sympathizer. But also, like, him being credited as a writer is also interesting on The Sympathizer, and like, having him on that aspect of it as well, which I do think, like, he is going to continue. Yeah, it's just all the... There's one other writer credited on some of the earlier episodes, but all of them have a Park Chan-wook and Don McKellar writing credit, which is very interesting.
Yeah. I think Little Drummer Girl is like a BBC AMC co-production, and this is like less a money. Big HBO yeah. show with Robert Downey Jr.
Sure. I do, unless I'm... getting the dates wrong, I think Little Drummer Girl was the first Park Chan-wook thing I'd ever seen.
That makes sense, for sure.
Because then I think I saw...
Had you seen...
It was either, like, right before or right after I'd seen The Handmaid in, like, 2018.
Sure.
But, and then I've seen Thirst for the show, and that's it. Mm-hmm. I still have not seen Decision to Leave or, like, you know, I've seen Spike Lee Old Boy like 1.5 times.
Sure, that counts for something. Yeah, I mean, you know, I like him. I'm a little cooler on Decision to Leave. Like, I think that movie is, like, okay, I think. But, like, is feels like a... That movie's, like, a little taxing in a way. Like, whereas, like, it's a lot of work to watch that movie, I feel like.
Yeah, I feel like I like Decision to Leave, but I feel like if I rewatched it, I would think it's great. It's sort of a movie that sort of asks a lot of just, like... It asks you to track a lot of things in a way where I think, like, on a second watch, you'd be able
Where you already have... Yeah.
You do it.
Yeah, when you have a more of a sense of it, right, I think it is a little bit easier. Just because it... Right. The rhythms of Decision to Leave, you feel like things are wrapping up, and then there's, like, a lot more. Like, it is, like, it's like, oh, there's, like, a whole other hour of this, essentially, where you're, like, where you're feeling the rhythms of, like, this feels like it's wrapping up, sort of. And going in with an experience, a previous experience of that does help on a second viewing, I think.
That's so true for so many movies. Just having all the information and being able to, like, what did I watch? I watched something recently and I was like, I never realized that, like, yada, yada, yada. And it really blew my mind. I was like, oh, they're, like, setting up this thing perfectly. I have one.
Sure.
But, yeah. But it's interesting because it's, like, Handmaiden is also obviously, like, a very, like, it's obviously, like, a very, like, twisty, dense, like, movie. But I feel like that one is, like, twisty in a way that sort of is ecstatic, that in a way that every time something is revealed, you're more excited by it. Whereas, like, every time something is revealed in Decision to Leave, you're like, huh, I guess I wasn't really expect this is, like, interesting that this is still going in this direction in a way that it is more like it's a little destabilizing.
I remembered it was seeing Long Day's Journey into Night a second time where very early on Tang Wei goes to the movies and she's like crying at the movies and the song they're playing in the movie is the song from the end of the movie. It's from the end of, and like hearing it, I was like, this is blowing my fucking mind. And that was just like one of those things. I was like, you wouldn't know that if you hadn't seen it before. And it's just like so rich. It makes it all so rich. What a movie. You get fresh eyes on it and you'll like it, Andy.
Uh-huh. We'll never know.
Yeah, do we want to talk about Hundreds of
Beavers? Yeah, let's talk about Hundreds of Beavers, Cullen.
What do you know about this movie, Emilio?
I know that it was like this, like, it's sort of like a mostly silent film.
Yeah.
Dialogue
free. It's a lot of, like, I know that it's sort of, I guess I don't know whether it's, like, effects or, like, puppets or whatever, but it's sort of, I know that it's, like, an interesting, like, small, like, sort of visual thing.
Yeah. So but it's, like, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, that is most of what my impression of it is.
Yeah. That's where I was before watching it. It's, like, word of mouth hit, sort of, like, Looney Tunes energy is what I heard, like, this slapsticky silent film homage type thing. And so it premiered at Fantastic Fest in 2022, just to link it back to festivals.
Sure.
And I feel like only I started hearing about it maybe late last year and mostly like this year. So
there was like, I first heard about it, there was like my local indie did a screening of it in their like their main theater. And, like, it sold out. Like, there was a sold out, like...
Sure.
Like, and so I was like, oh, this was, like, at the end of last year. And then...
Oh, okay, sure.
I think. I forget when exactly it was, but it was, you know, it was a couple of months ago, at least. Like, it was a fairly early... Like, if you watch their, like... On their website, I think they have, like, audiences are going crazy for this sort of, like... And I think there's, like, film of, like, that audience watching it and, like, going crazy or whatever. So much so that they brought it back for like a second screening, like weeks or months later. And by that time I had a more of an idea of what it was. Cause I was at the time I was like, what is it? Like, how do all these people know about this? Like, what is happening? Yeah. I was like, is it a crowdfunding thing? Are they, like, YouTubers or something that, like, has, like, a weird cult? Like,
I don't really know the people.
Yeah, me neither.
Mike Czeslik and Ryland Brixen Coltues are the writers. Mike Czeslik also directed it, and Ryland Brixen Coltues is the lead.
Yeah, right. In our circles on the internet, people were, like, taking notice of it. Yeah.
Exactly. But I before watching, I didn't really know what to expect other than it was supposed to be, like, silly.
Right. I had seen the trailer, I think. And so
I had not seen
of the aesthetic sense.
I'd seen the poster.
Sure. It's a great poster.
I think it's a pretty great movie, too. It's very, very impressive, I think.
Sure.
Like, you really can't undersell how genius it is, I think. They really, like, it's just so, like, deceptively simple where you watch this movie of, like, it's this one guy, and every single animal that he comes across with is a guy in an animal costume that's, right, like a onesie with a big.
They refer to them as mascots, like, as the performers, sure, okay, in them are like the mascot, yeah, performers. Like, it's like,
yeah, me describing a big costume not knowing the word mascot. Obviously, that is what it is. The movie opens with this big, like, song about Applejack whiskey or something, like apple cider, and ends up being a big explosion, and, like, the right guy's buried
he's
under.
He's right. He's snow, like, it's him, like, in the wilderness. Like, he's isolated. Yeah.
So then the movie is like, here's this guy just, like, trying to start a fire, trying to get food, and all this stuff, and he keeps encountering different things. But it's so, it's a great, like, synthesis of culture, like, millennial culture, I think. It is. You're so dense with references that are so, like, oblique that you will only know after, like, having spent your life on the internet. It really is a exciting experiment in that regard, I think. Like, it starts, and this guy sees this, like, there's a rabbit that he's trying to get food, and they do the, like, Metal Gear Solid, like, exclamation mark on the head, and I was like, whoa, that's crazy that they've got this. Because it is, like, big costumes, a lot of props, and, like, dense with special effects, dense with, you know, sound effect. It's got a very good score, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And but then they'll just be, like, very cheesy jokes sometimes, like GIF references, and you're just like, come on, what are we doing? But there is a charm to it also, I think, where it's, like, even at its chuggiest, it's just like, we've all done it. We've all lived it. It's funny. It's just like giving it back to us as a movie. But then, I mean, the gags in it are also very.
Sure. Funny. Yeah. It's very, like, it's very lovingly constructed. Like, it's, yes, like, it's this thing where, like, they really, like, you could tell they, like, sat down and were like, what are these, like, what are these things that we love? And, like, it is, like, you know, video games, Looney Tunes, like, yes, silly,
very, very,
like,
video
that sort of. That sort of, like, all that stuff coming together of, like, how do we make a pure slapstick movie, like, that is just, like, just gag after gag after gag. And, like, certainly, like, I'm not mad at it at all. Like, I'm very happy that they...
I want to say again, I'm not mad.
I'm very happy that they were able to make this
I'm
movie.
I'm completely calm.
I think it's, like, a wonderful testament to, like, the creative spirit that this movie exists, for sure.
Yeah, I guess as an outsider, that was my one impression of it. It's just like, I feel like at once every, like, 2 years, there's a movie of this, like this, where it's like these people just really loved the craft, and they,
right,
just went in and they just, like, really made a movie that was about the craft of making all this shit.
Right, and it, like, yeah, the movie is like, it is just that. Like, it is exactly what, yes, it is. There's no, like, depth to it, really. It is like it's all on the screen of, like, pure love for, like, constructing gags and movies, like, essentially, like,
yeah,
and, like, that's, like, what the experience of watching it is.
Which is, it makes, yeah, sense that it is a big word of mouth, like, theatrical hit. Like,
right.
Seeing this with a hype crowd, I imagine, is, like...
Right, it's probably a rock concert experience sort of deal. Sure, where it's, sure. like, people are just, like, you know... You hear, like, the different pockets reacting to different things. And, like, you sure, hear when yeah, the whole crowd goes at stuff. And, like, yeah, it's, like, you know... I would say, personally, the humor was not, like, exactly on my level. I found it...
A little juvenile?
I found it more amusing than funny a lot of the time. which is, like, totally fine. Like... not even, like, juvenile. Like, I can like juveniles. Like, I love, like, Austin Powers yeah. and, like, things like that. Like, but, I don't want to totally be like, I'm a fuddy-duddy snob or whatever. I yeah. love... I love stupid comedy. I
prefer the written word.
not at all. I love stupid comedy. Like, there's a lot of stupid comedy that I love. I, you know. But, yeah.
I'm more of a David Sedaris guy.
Listen, I'm a Dave Barry guy. Like, this, I have yeah. no pretensions.
Like, meat and potato. Like,
I'm not trying
Andy
to be pretentious
likes, we talked about it. Andy loves the Capitol Steps.
I love Doonesbury.
I love to make jokes about the Capitol Steps. Doonesbury. I mean, I read it every day, certainly, when growing up. Like, you know.
You weren't laughing, though. You were like, this is so important.
Like, that was... Yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to make the hundreds of viewers with the tone of a New Yorker cartoon.
You know, it right, it just, it wasn't like exactly tickling my funny bone particularly, like, which yeah. is totally fine. Like, I have no ill will towards it. I'm so happy that so many people actually find it like really funny and really joyful. Like, that's like, I have not indicting the movie at all for not speaking specifically to my sense of humor. Like, I have plenty of things that speak to my sense of humor. I don't need everything to. That's totally fine. The other thing about the movie is it's an hour and 40 minutes long, which is like, it's ambitious for a film like this that is just pure craft and gags. And like, there's like, you're getting what is on the screen at any given time. And I feel like there's a lot of ramp up, and there's like a very long section sort of in the middle where he keeps like wandering around the woods, and it keeps cutting to this map, and like, you see him whistle and, like, move around the circle or whatever, and, like, that...
Yeah, so he... for Emilio, he finds, like, a, you know, a merchant, and it's, like, this guy who's got a big trading board that is, like, this is where it's the most video gamey, is, like, you get,
two coins,
you kill, like, you a get rabbit a, or, right, a, yeah. like, a skunk or a raccoon or whatever, you can trade it in for a knife. Like, if you have two beavers, you can trade it in for a big trap. You can, like... So it's all about, like, upgrading his kit and things like that. But it also is... There's, like, the legendary fur trapper who he starts, like, apprenticing with. And they're going through the trap line, and it's, like, this huge detailed map. And then the legendary fur trapper ends up dying... And he has to start a new map. So there is a long section where it's, like, him going to a spot, finding what's there, establishing, like, the point. And it is just, like, cut back to the map, cut back to the...
Like, waypointy, like...
Yeah, it is. It is like that. Breath of the Wild. He finds there are...
Right, and a lot of... Right, it's like...
He's falling in holes that are very, like, portally, where they take him to different spots. Right. And he's, like, setting up the trap and, like, doing it wrong and doing it again and, like, trying to get it right.
Right.
And then eventually, like, starts picking up more and more and more, and then has to go on trial for killing so many beavers.
Right. I feel right.
Is on beaver
eventually,
trial.
Right. Once you, like, are in the society of the beavers or whatever, it's, like, it's in a different gear, and, like, I feel like it is, like, it is less taxing to me in that time. But, like, I feel like there is, like, it takes a long time to sort of get where it's going, I feel like, in a way.
I think it is, like... You know, if you can see it in the theater, that's the ideal, I would imagine. Sure. Locked in, just seeing it all with, like, you know, a hype crowd.
Yeah.
But if you are, like, watching it at home, throw it on with some friends.
Right.
Don't feel bad about, like, talking over it.
So this is a movie about horde mode?
Kind of. There's, like, it is, I think you would appreciate it on the level of, like, if you have, like, spent enough time on the internet, played enough video games, and seen enough movies, it'll just, like, hit responses for you, like, that are enjoyable. There's a lot of good, like,
because I mean, that's surprising, because like, Andy is the biggest gamer of all of us.
I know, yeah. We did talk about the only video game Andy's ever played is Miles Morales. He only got in now. He bought a PS5 for that.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. But I there's like, because everyone's dressed like mascots, there's all these like physical stunts that feel sort of jackassy in a way that is very funny. There's a great, I think my favorite joke is the lead character goes, his name is Jean or John Kayak. And he, at one point is using a telescope, but it's a pepper mill. So he just grinds a bunch of pepper into his eyes. And it's like, that is
right. Well, then, and then he sneezes, which creates a huge icicle, like out of his nose, which he then breaks off and uses as a telescope. Like that's like a,
I think I missed that because I was laughing so hard at the pepper.
Right.
I, like my eyes were closed because I couldn't, once he ground pepper into his eyes.
Right.
I
and was, then we were all like, why does he even have a peppermint? Like that sort of incredulous response. Lost. Like what's going on? Like
it really, that's like, but that's when you're like so deep in that. It's like, here is something that is just purely, even at the point of the movie, like ridiculous. Like there is no one's eating really in the movie. No one's using seasonings, and it's just like, how does he have one long pepper mill this whole time? It really got me.
Yeah.
But it is, it's funny and it's worth watching.
Yeah, for sure.
And with special
presentations.
What do we got?
A couple, honestly.
Take us away, Cullen.
Chris Pine WTF is very interesting. A lot of great moments. I was like, in my head, I was just like, these guys, I know exactly what this is going to be. They're just going to only talk about LA and both of their vibes, I think, are very simpatico. But there's a great bit where, like, Marin's just like, yeah, I grew up in Albuquerque. And Chris Pine goes, grew up in Albuquerque? Fuck. It's just like, that's the energy Chris Pine's bringing to it. They talk about Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit a little bit, even though he talks about being disappointed with how it was received. It found its fans, you know, obviously. Mike Lee, Abigail's Party, one of his early BBC teleplays, and I think it was one of his, you know, stage plays as well that he just used, but so good, so funny. Alison Steadman is the lead. She plays Beverly, who's like throwing this party, and every single thing she says is funny. She's like the most annoying person in this movie. It really, I feel like Lee, because even in Life is Sweet, they're all like annoying to each other, and it is so endearing. And I think this, the energy in Abigail's Party is also there, but it's just like a completely funny, like shocking movie. I really, like, screamed, oh my god, multiple times. I'm just like, I can't believe they are, like, saying this and doing this. It's a very bold movie in a lot of ways. But I just love, like, people arguing and, like, trying to, like, have these tense arguments in front of guests at this dinner party. While also, like, trying to make sure everyone has their drink and everyone has their food and is comfortable. And it's like, let's put this on, let's do this. Like, very, very funny. And an awesome soundtrack. Oh, and Mike Lee and Spike Lee. We got Spike in now. Summer of Sam, incredible. Talk about a great soundtrack. Great movie, on Criterion Channel. I feel like I'd seen people talk about that a good Blu-ray hadn't been released of Summer of Sam. Maybe it has since. But the version on Criterion Channel is gorgeous. The transfer they have there is very, very good. And it expires at the end of the month. May.
Sure. Get to it.
May 2024, if you're listening in the future.
That's right.
But it might be back on.
Maybe,
by then.
Maybe it's somewhere else
by now. Yeah. Whenever you're listening,
just keep going, keep stretching here.
President Baron Trump.
That's very far in the future.
Yeah, 40 years in the future.
Maybe they change the rule.
That's right. I mean, sure.
If you're tall enough.
That's right. You the presidency loses the age restriction, but it now becomes a you must be this tall to like it's an amusement park ride.
No, I just think that once you're a certain age, you can add your height to it. So it's like he's maybe, you know, not 35, but he can claim height as age for the presidency. Look, I didn't vote for him. I'm dead. By the time Baron Trump's president, Andy, I'm 6 feet deep. But people are still listening to Can I Kick It? Isn't that crazy to think about?
I'm not saying anything. I'm just going to let you keep talking.
Just leave me in there.
I wanted to see how long that would go for.
Yes, and.
Not really. Andy, what's your special presentation?
What is my special presentation? I have sort of been like, what am I watching? Have I talked about Elsbeth yet? I don't know if I have. I'm gonna
probably.
I mean,
maybe just in real life.
Certainly in real life. Yes. Elsbeth has been airing on CBS. It is also available on Paramount Plus. It is formerly CBS All Access. To shout out to the old days. It's really just charming and fun, and like they have like it's Carrie Preston, Michael Emerson's wife, Carrie Preston, who plays Elsbeth. This is a reference to a tweet that Michael Emerson tweeted, where he just tweeted, "Elsbeth is played by my wife, Carrie Preston," with no context, which is delightful. She's Columbo, essentially, right? She's in New York City now. She's on a consent decree to observe New York City police officers to make sure they're not doing bad things. And it seems like she might be about to stumble onto a conspiracy of some sort. But every week she investigates a murder. Elsbeth immediately sort of hones in on like who actually did it, and like bugs everyone else around her into like them actually solving it properly. It's a very delightful, it's a lot of fun, like, every week has, like, a big guest star as, like, the murderer, we've had, like, Jane Krakowski, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, you know, all sorts of people. There's a fun, good wife, good fight-esque, device of, that show had the judges, where, like, all the judges were played by, like, older character actors, like, each one having, like, a crazy quirk. And this one, she's constantly working with different detectives who are assigned to these murders. And, like, they're all, like, you know, they're fun personalities for her to bounce off of. Everyone's very constantly annoyed and flustered by her. There was also, yeah, the one where Retta was the murderer, had, like, a sequence where, just out of nowhere, which was largely sent in, like, the Hamptons, where they played, like, 45 seconds of Another Winter in a Summer Town from the Grey Gardens musical, like, while Elsbeth, like, sat on a bench, which was, like, a crazy thing to see on television, because that musical, like, came out in, like, 2007 and, like, has not had much of a life since. But yeah, it's a constant delight every week. It's, if you're looking for a show to recommend to your parents, tell them to watch Elsbeth. Just got renewed for a second season, and I'm all in. And Evil's coming back soon, so we're really having a great time, us fans of the King's television output. Emilio.
Yeah. God, it's always hard to think of things that I've done. But you know what? Yesterday, I purchased the early access version of Hades 2, and I played a lot of Hades 2 recently. Hades 1, one of the great games. Hades 2 seemed very good so far. Excited to keep playing it.
Mm-hmm.
Love me some Hades. Check out Hades and Hades 2, everybody.
Never played Hades.
Should I? Yeah, should I check it out? Will I
Hades rocks. Figure it out? Hades one of the great games.
right.
I can get Truly, on Switch, right?
Yeah, Hades is on Switch. Hades is basically everywhere at this point. It was so successful, but I truly just love that game so much. It's a great podcast game, I'll say.
Sure.
It's an elite podcast game. So if you ever like, I'm gonna listen to a podcast, I just need something to do, pop in some Hades, run a couple rounds.
What was that game? Dead Cells.
It's a roguelike like Dead Cells.
Sure.
But I think I prefer it to Dead Cells, but Dead Cells is also a very good game. But yeah, Hades 2, they did it. They seem to have done it again. I've only played like 3 hours of it so far because I bought it yesterday. But
sure,
seems very good. Excited. I played so much. It's one of those things where you play so much Hades, you're like, I still am having fun playing Hades, but it would be cool if I had this had new things, and right. They gave me new
things. If it was the same but slightly different.
Yes. The environments are different, so I'm just excited.
Yeah.
And with that, we can release our audience. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.